We were speaking yesterday about the mendicant orders, and we noticed at the end of the hour, number two was Dominic de Guzman, and we looked at the career of Dominic, and then number three is the Dominicans, which I already spoke about a bit yesterday. The Dominicans were the order that St. Dominic founded. They call themselves the Order of Preachers to this day. When you see a book written with a name followed by capital O period, capital P, it means it is a member of the Dominican order. Dominic had a definite interest in scholarship, in study, and preaching right from the start. And this is characteristic of the Dominicans to this day. Some of the most scholarly work in the Roman Catholic Church is done by the Dominicans. We noticed yesterday how the Pope ordered the Dominicans to undertake the Inquisition. We will look at the Inquisition under a later head. But the Dominicans received a very bad name for their extensive activity through the next few centuries in connection with the Inquisition. It does not seem, however, that this was part of Dominic's original ideal for the order that he founded. Some of the Dominicans, those which caused them to be listed under this head, mendicant orders, came from the influence of the other order that we look at later, right away, the orders that St. Francis formed. And so we won't look at them in detail now, but go on to number four, Francis Bernardoni. Francis Bernardoni, B-E-R-N-A-R-D-O-N-E. Francis Bernardoni. Now, you don't need to remember the name Bernardoni. Very few people are familiar with it. I had to look it up myself for today. He is almost universally called Francis of Assisi, which is the town from which he came. And that you certainly should remember. A-S-S-I-S-I. Assisi is a hill town in Italy. But Francis Bernardoni, who lived from 1182 to 1226, and as you see, was only 44 years of age when he died, was a man who was certainly a natural genius. He had very remarkable natural abilities. He had a considerable amount of originality of thinking. He had a personality which is very remarkable and unusual. He would have been a marked character anywhere, in any particular situation into which he had been born. And he has exerted a tremendous influence since. There are many Protestants who have written books highly praising Francis of Assisi. And he has been, many non-Christians have highly praised him. You seldom find anything written that is really critical of Francis of Assisi. The effects of his activity have been tremendous in the Roman Catholic Church and through thousands of others whose whole lives have been affected by the order that he formed. Many of the details of the order, however, are due not to Francis' desire at all, but to the way in which it was molded by others and turned away from a great part of Francis' original idea. But Francis is a character whose personality has had a tremendous influence. And as I say, it started this order, which has had tremendous influence and activity through the years. So we should take a little time looking at his life. He was the son of a wealthy man in Assisi. As a young man, he had all the privileges that money and social standing could give you in those days. But he was never happy with it. And he had, from the very earliest time, he was greatly affected by the reading of the Bible in the services and by contrast between the lives of the wealthy ecclesiastics and the teachings of Jesus as he heard them read in the service. Some have spoken of him as illiterate. He himself, toward the end of his life, said he was poor and weak and illiterate. Whether this means that he could not read, that he didn't have a primary education, I don't think that's true. There's considerable evidence that he could read and write, but he evidently didn't have much education. And the word illiterate was used for those who had not gone in on advanced education. But quite in contrast to Dominic, his interest was never in education. And he would have been very much surprised if he had known that many, many books would be written in subsequent years by the Franciscan. Francis never thought in the first place of founding an order. He simply was looking for what he felt was the purpose of his life, and he felt a great revulsion against the pleasures which he had the means of having, but which he did not find as satisfactory. And one time he had a vision in which he said he entered into marriage with poverty. He said that he went with some companions in search of poverty. The two old men pointed out her abode on a high mountain, and there poverty, seated on the throne of her neediness, received them. And he praised her as the inseparable companion of the Lord, the mistress and queen of the virtues. And poverty replied she had been with Adam in paradise, but had become a homeless wanderer after the fall, until the Lord came and made her over to his elect. And he joined himself to poverty and declared that henceforth he would have no possessions whatever, and that he would joy and glory in poverty. He heard the words read, "Preach the kingdom of heaven is at hand, heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, cast out devils, provide neither silver nor gold nor brass in your purses," from the gospel. And he even threw away his staff and his purse and his shoes, and determined to make these the rule of his life. He dressed scantily, took up his abode among the lepers, washing their sores, and trying to work to earn his living from place to place, working for it, and if work was not available, begging for it, but preferring to work, but not taking money and not saving anything. Perhaps he was influenced by the fact that the Benedictine orders and the other orders, which were sworn to poverty, chastity, and obedience, had now for many centuries interpreted that as meaning that the individual monk was to be poor, to possess nothing, but that the order could possess. And therefore he found many of these monks were living in great wealth, actually enjoying the tremendous endowments that had come to their monasteries, but claiming to be in utter poverty because they personally had nothing. Even the clothes on their back belonged to the monastery. But they had very sumptuous things. They had great luxuries of every type. And Francis, how much he had revolted against that, reacted against that, I don't know. But at least many of his followers in subsequent years were influenced tremendously by their reaction against it. Francis at first had no thought of starting an order. He simply broke off with his father. He said, "Up to this time I've called Pietro Bernardoni Father, but now I desire to serve God and to say nothing else than our Father in heaven." And so he went about and tried to live in utter poverty and practicing asceticism, and he carried it to such an extreme that he was in very poor health his last 2 years and died at the age of 44. But everyone who came in contact with Francis was impressed with the idea that he was utterly sincere in these views, utterly sincere in this attitude, and he had a personality which was evidently a very attractive personality. Even the animals were attracted to him. He used to go out sometimes and preach to the birds, and the birds would be attracted to him, they said. They said that one time he was in a town where there was a fierce wolf, which was a terror of the neighborhood. And Francis said, "I'll speak to the wolf." And he went out into the area where the wolf was, and the wolf ran at him with open mouth. But when he came near, he laid himself at his feet like a lamb when Francis said, "Brother Wolfe, in the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to do no evil to me or to any man." And Francis promised the Wolfe forgiveness for all past offenses on condition of his never doing harm again to human beings. The beast ascended to the compact by lowering his head and kneeling before it. He became the pet of the town. Now, of course, this is one of the many stories they tell about Francis, and these stories kept growing in later years. And how much truth there is in any particular story is hard to tell. But there would seem to be no question that he did have a personality which had an effect upon people and even upon animals, and that the animals did feel a difference between him and most people. When he eventually, other people gathered around him and were attracted by what he said and decided to make their lives similar to his, and he thought he would like to organize an order, or at least to get the approval of the church. In 1210, he and some of his companions went to Rome and were received by Innocent III. And the English chronicler, who's written the story of his life, including this event, says that in order to test his sincerity, the Pope said, "Go, brother, go to the pigs, to whom you are more fit to be compared than to men, and roll with them, and preach to them the rules you so ably set forth." And Francis obeyed. And then returning, he said, "My Lord, I've done so." And then the Pope gave his blessing to the brotherhood and informally sanctioned their rule and bade them go and preach the repentance. Well, these were Francis's ideas, and he wanted these people to work, or if they couldn't find work, to beg, but not to save, not to have any money, not to be satisfied and to rejoice in getting along without things, and to devote themselves to trying to help others. He evidently had a great respect for the church. He never was ordained himself. He was a deacon. He was ordained as a deacon, but he never became a priest. And he had great respect for the church and great fear of heretics whom he thought would produce terrible harm. And so they found nothing in what he said to lead them to question his loyalty to the church organization. In fact, he was not one who was anxious to develop ideas or to oppose any organization or even to build an organization. In fact, in his early days, his followers were very, very free, and he desired them so to be. One time, he turned to one of the men who was following him, and who was evidently a drone, and he said, "Look here." He said, "You spend your..." He said, "You're always ready to eat everything you can get a hold of." He said, "You're actually, while you talk about poverty, you seem to want to enjoy yourself, and you don't spend half the time in praying or begging or working the rest of us do. You get out. We don't want you in our fellowship." But his attitude was one of very free, great freedom to come and go as his followers might wish to do. But eventually it grew into quite an organization with people tremendously impressed by him and by the ideals that he set forth. And I mentioned to you yesterday how Innocent III said he had his dream, and he saw this Italian, Francis, and the Spaniard, Dominic, holding up the walls of the church, which seemed to be about to fall over. And Innocent III gave a general sanction to the order. His successor established them both as definite orders, giving them the privilege of being independent of the bishops all over, everywhere. They were not subject to the ordinary control, but directly responsible to the Pope. And so Francis had this great group of people who were stirred by his personality and by his ideas of poverty and simply helping others and doing good, and one of the cardinals took a great interest in Francis and helped Francis, and Francis began to pay great attention to what this cardinal was doing and to his ideas. And then Francis undertook a missionary trip to the East. He went through the Near East on a missionary trip to Egypt and Syria, and when he came back, he found that the cardinal had changed the rules of his society, had introduced the idea of discipline, of absolute obedience to the head of the society, and had permitted the society to receive certain gifts from people who wanted to give them houses to live in instead of their having to live in old abandoned buildings or sleep out as they had been doing, and had introduced a definite rule for the order, which was more like the rules of the other monastic orders. And he had appointed a member of the order who was a doctor of laws and a member of the nobility as the general of the order. And when Francis found this, he very humbly accepted. And he said to the others, "From henceforth, I am dead for you. Here is Brother Peter de Catana, whom you and I will obey." And prostrating himself, he promised the man who had superseded him obedience and submission. And for the next 4 years of Francis' life, he was in poor health, and people were revering him as a great saint. They were paying tremendous homage to him in many ways, but the control of his order was in the hands of these other men. He was largely a figurehead, one whom they give great lip service and great praise in his presence, but the ideas were being very largely changed. And so when Francis died, he wrote a will, which Schoff says is one of the most affecting pieces in Christian literature. Here he calls it his, he calls himself the little brother. And he says that he urges the other members of the order to follow his original ideals. He urges them to work and to try to earn their living by working, but if they can't find work, to beg, but not to have any possessions. And he urged that the order should have no possessions. That poverty should be not simply the individuals, but should be the order. As a whole group, as a group, should possess nothing. And he forbade their receiving special privileges from the Pope, and he expressed his original ideas in this will, but yet he urged them all to obey the minister general and declared he's ready to obey the general of the order himself, and to be absolutely humble and subject to him. Within a few years after Francis' death, the story was told that he had, from his constant contemplation of the sufferings of Christ, that he had received on his body the marks of the 5 wounds of Christ, from the nails in the hands and the feet and the spear thrust into the side. And there is much reason to think that such marks may have appeared on his body. On the other, some question it, because the papal bull issued just 2 years after his death declaring him a saint. Dominic was dead 20 or 30 years before they declared him a saint. But this papal bull did not say anything about it, and it seems as if it would have been one of the strongest proofs, and so some question whether it really happened, whether it was a story later on. But there have been other cases where that has occurred. There's no reason to think it may not have. It does seem, at any rate, that he was a very unusual character, in many ways a very attractive character, certainly a very self-sacrificing character. He had a great love of nature, a love of animals, a desire to be helpful to every living being. As far as our evidence goes, he is a very, very different type of character from Dominic. But Francis' ideas of carrying out their poverty in the and being absolutely self-sacrificing and looking to either to work or to people's gifts for their support was taken over to some extent by Dominic's men. Both of them, of course, had the idea, different from the previous idea of the monastery, that the monks were not simply people who went apart by themselves to develop their spiritual life, but that they were people who were to be out in the world, trying to do good in the world. And Francis' idea of doing good in the world seems to have been largely to help people, to be kind to them, to simply give personal kindnesses and helps and be self-sacrificing, while Dominic's idea was to take what he considered as the truth and to present it, to preach it, and to make it effective in the people with whom he came in contact. But this idea of the monastery as not being a retreat from the world, but meant to go out into the world and influence it, was a tremendous change. And then, of course, the idea that going out in the world, they would, if necessary, beg their way. They came to be called the mendicant orders. And then they came, and another name was given to them was the friars. And so the, any history of the Middle Ages speaks of the origin of the friars or of the mendicant orders, which occurred at this period in the beginning of the 13th century. Today, these are two of the four leading orders in the Roman Church. I don't know the statistics. There probably are 200 orders in the Roman Church, but my guess would be that these four might have as many members as all the rest put together. I don't know. At least they are the largest, the most influential by far to this day. And of those four, one is the Benedictines, which we notice was the very first of the order's founders. But two of the others are these two, the Franciscans and the Dominicans. Now we go on then to number five, the Franciscans. It's hard to make a line between four and five because of the Franciscans began when people began to follow Francis, and Francis' influence continued among the Franciscans afterwards. But as in the case of the Dominicans, in fact far more than in the case of the Dominicans, the influence of the Pope and his associates changed and altered the attitude. In the Dominicans, the Pope changed them from being simply a preaching order into the directors of the Inquisition, and made that one of their principal activities during the years when the Inquisition was active, which was a number of centuries. During the in the case of Francis, he changed them from people who were simply self-sacrificing and helping people and not owning anything to people who were actively performing what the Pope and the hierarchy felt was for the advancement of the Church. And there, the Pope and his associates, and this Cardinal Ugolini later became a Pope and did much to help the order, but at the same time exerted tremendous influence on the order. These changes, in the case of the Franciscans, ran right headlong into this which Francis had emphasized so very much, that he wanted his followers to observe absolute poverty, not merely as individuals, but as a group. And while in other orders you might find the individual said he owned nothing, yet the monastery might be tremendously wealthy and they might be enjoying greater luxury in every way than the most wealthy people of the community were observing. Francis desired that his order as an order should own nothing. And so when the Pope tried to change that and the Franciscans resisted, then they made a compromise. They made a very nice, very clever compromise. They said, the order shall not own anything. But they said, if people want to give gifts to the order, let them give the gifts to the Pope to be used for the order. And consequently, many people began to give, and in fact, many of the Franciscans were very active in going about trying to get people to give things to the, not to the individual, not to the order, but to the Pope to be used for the benefit of the order. And so within a few years, there were great, expensive monasteries all over Europe, which were owned by the Pope as trustee for the order, and which were in the hands of the order just as much as if they had been given directly to the order. And this continued for over 100 years, until in the next century, John 23rd became disgusted at the whole business, Pope John 22nd, rather, who we will look at later, and he said, this is all foolishness. He said, all the other orders own their property. Why say the Franciscans don't? Actually they do just as much. He said, I renounce all property of the Franciscans. It no longer belongs to me. I turned it over to the Franciscans. And so since that time,
that particular fiction has been dropped, and the order owns its property. But in the Franciscans, there remained in succeeding centuries a large number of people who were attracted to the order by the life of St. Francis and by his ideals, and who wanted to carry out the will of Francis. And these were always saying, we should not have any property. We should not have anything to eat except what we either earn or is given to us at that time. Nothing which is bought with money that has been given before. We should not have anything like this. And these people came to be called the observants, those who wanted to observe Francis's ideals. While the those who said, well, Francis was a great man, and his ideals are wonderful, but after all, we live in a real world, and we've got to have something to live on, and who consequently were pushing the order in the direction of being like the other orders, they called them the conventual, because they lived in convents, which belonged to the order. And so, for many decades, there was strife within the order between the observance and the conventuals, until eventually they divided it into two different orders. There was the order of the conventual Franciscans and the order of the observant Franciscans. And the Franciscans, though, have always at least given lip service to a certain amount of Francis' ideal work. Thus, if you see a book written by a Dominican, we notice it will have after the man's name, O.P., the Order of Preachers. Just as one by a Jesuit will have S.J. The Jesuits were not founded, as we noticed, till 300 years later. But if you see one written by a Franciscan, and there have been many very scholarly books written by Franciscans, it will be have after his name the letters O.F.M., which stand for the Latin word, the Order of the Minor Brothers, the Order of the Lesser Brothers. And so Francis' terminology is still used, and it is true that the Dominicans are often thought of as an aristocratic order, while the Franciscans, in all their forms, and doubtless to some extent in those whom they attract to the order or whom they receive into it, take that attitude of being, as Francis himself called himself, the lesser brother. He said, your little brother, he called himself. And they are the order of the lesser brothers. Yes, Mr.
They put into two different orders, and now they're back together.
To how great an extent they're back, I don't know. There's always been a constant shift in some extent. But within the next century, there was a division. Whether they were, I would incline to think there still probably is a division of organization. Because about 1500, a third order developed out of another one, out of the Franciscan, which wanted to observe it more fully, called itself the Capuchins. And they are Franciscans also. But they call themselves the Capuchins, they have their own general. And today, in any Romanist country, you will find the Franciscans with brown, long brown robes. And it looks like coarse material. The Dominicans will have much finer clothing in their robes, but the rather coarse brown robe with a rope tied around it represents the Franciscan. But the Capuchins wear beards. The Capuchins do not shave. They have the beard, the ordinary Franciscans do not. And the Capuchins were founded about 1500, and their third general, who was a very great preacher and went all over Italy preaching. At the time of Martin Luther, it was discovered that he was preaching salvation by faith. And he had to flee for his life and became a Protestant minister. And so the Catholic Encyclopedia says that the Capuchins suffered a great blow by their third general having apostatized. But before he fled, he had had a tremendous influence. He was a tremendous preacher, a very, very capable man. But of course, after he fled Italy, he was a great disadvantage because his language was Italian. And in other countries, it wasn't so easy at his age to learn to He has fine figure in other languages. But we'll look at the Capuchins later on. Yes? The great service of Martin Luther was to make the scriptural teaching on salvation by simple faith in Christ, to express it in very clear language. And it's like so many steps forward in science and other fields. So many steps. We take a thing which we have understood to some extent and we express it very simply and clearly. And then it's so simple we all say, why didn't everybody know this? But it was not expressed so clearly, but it doubtless was apprehended. And my guess would be that among the early Franciscans, there were many who were putting their, and among some of the Dominicans too, putting their faith in simple faith in Christ and his death for salvation. But there were many others who were simply trying to, thinking, well, the church understands these things, we do what the church says, and we'll be saved. So we make a clear distinction between salvation by faith and salvation by works, and yet you go into almost any of our churches and you'll find many people whose ideas get hazy on it. And the ideas were not clearly differentiated, but certainly the teaching was in many of their sermons and their attitudes were very definitely in this direction, and yet there was a constant drift away from it. And when Martin Luther began his work, there were many of the Franciscans and of the Dominicans who became his followers and became among the very leaders in the early Protestant movement. He had tremendous influence on drawing people from these orders to see that a part of what they were teaching was had a greater importance in relation to the whole than they realized, and bringing out clearly what it meant. And they said, this is what we have believed all along, and we have been drifting into these errors, and they stood with him. And of course, what the Counter-Reformation did was to draw a line through and stop that approach to those people. Well, yes? Well, we come to that. Yeah, that's our very next point. No, it isn't. It's our second point. Thank you for mentioning it. It is important. And I always am glad when a question deals with the next point or the second of my outline, because it shows people are thinking along the line we're dealing, and also shows my outline is logical, Mr. Raymond. But I think every year I make it more logical, because I always see little points in which it can be improved. But number six here, we only take a minute on number six, but it should be mentioned. I'll call number six the tertiary. T-E-R-T-I-A-R-I-E-S. The tertiary. But under it, I will discuss the related orders of the Franciscans and the Dominicans. Dominic and Francis, of course, originally, their work was definitely a male work. It was a work among men, and they both laid great stress on chastity and on the rather ascetic ideal of the Roman Church of having no, in fact, they went so far as to have very little direct contact with women at all. They were very strict in this. But very soon there were women who were interested in what they were doing. And in the case of the Franciscans, there was a woman named Clara, who as a young girl became greatly interested in Francis and what he was doing, and asked him to form a group of women like the Franciscans. And so they formed a group of Franciscan sisters. And these Franciscan sisters, they often called the Poor Clares after Clare, because they called them the Poor Clares because the idea of the Franciscans was to be absolutely poor. And they simply lived in abandoned houses and that sort of thing. Well, the women could hardly do that. So that from the very start, the Francis ideal could hardly be carried out fully in the case of the Franciscan women. But yet, as far as they could, they carried them out, and then when the Franciscan order was made more like a regular order with its strong discipline and so on, the same thing was introduced into the Franciscan sisters. And the same thing occurred in the case of the Dominicans. And right across the street here, we have the Dominican sisters who purchased this very elaborate old Elkins estate over here across the street, and they have retreats very frequently there. And there have been at least a dozen times I've found a group of people wandering through our halls asking me, is this the Dominican sisters' retreat house? And I have directed them how to get over there to their retreat house. But they are very active in carrying on the ideals of the Dominicans, is this part of the Dominican order over here, the women. Well, they got the women with the Franciscans, the women with the Dominicans. Now, it's interesting that 300 years later, when Ignatius Loyola founded the Jesuits, there were many women who took tremendous interest in it and who gave great sums of money to the Jesuits. And the Jesuits never had any idea against taking money. They wanted to take all they could and to use it to advance their purposes. But though Ignatius Loyola received lots of money and help from wealthy women, they were constantly after him to organize a women's order of Jesuits, and he refused absolutely. So there never was a women's order of Jesuits. But the Dominicans and the Franciscans, there's also the related women's orders, and then they found it formed in both cases what they call the tertiary. You see, the third. And the tertiary consists of people who are laymen. People who are living their normal lives, people who are not subject to the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, but who are interested in the order, interested in advancing its purposes, and having certain things that they do, certain restrictions upon them, and they go to a ceremony and are made tertiaries. And so they have Franciscan tertiaries and Dominican tertiaries to this day. That's number six. Now number seven, we will call the Augustinians, the Premonstrants, and the Carmelites. The Augustinians, the Premonstrants, 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 and the Carmelites. Now the question was raised about Augustine having had a rule for his the house which he had near his home, in which he had people who desired to study and develop their spiritual life. And Augustine, this was before the order of St. Benedict was founded, when Augustine had this, and Augustine simply made some rules for these men who were thus under his instruction. And these rules included poverty and obedience, and that is obedience to him to some extent, including chastity. But there were many in the early day who thus gathered groups of men around them to study and to develop the spiritual life, and for the purpose of living together in a reasonable fashion, they made rules for them. But these are not orders, because they were not continuing organizations with permanent vows being taken. And when Augustine found that a third of the people who had sworn to chastity or to obedience and were living in his house there and under these rules actually had property and had business dealings, he became so indignant he removed the rule altogether and said there's no sense in having rules that aren't obeyed. And he made various changes from time to time. He did not found any continuing order. But Augustine was a tremendous thinker, as you know. Perhaps he thought on too many subjects, because he didn't perhaps work it out as well as he might have in various fields. He wrote on everything imaginable. He even wrote a book on music. He wrote on just about everything you can think of, in particular everything in the religious line. And his mind was filled with very interesting ideas, some of which he worked out very thoroughly, and other of which you might say simply threw out and simply dealt with briefly. But Augustine, in later years, when various groups would want to form a group to work together and live together, it was very natural to look to the rules that Augustine had suggested or used. And so various groups came to call themselves Augustinians. And then
the time came when these mendicants had been established, and there were a group of these various groups that were holding, as they called it, the rule of St. Augustine, who united together into a large group they called Augustinians and became like the mendicants. And so you had two different organizations. You had conventual Augustinians and you had mendicants, or eremitical, as they sometimes call themselves, Augustinians. But the Augustinians have Villanova University here, which they own and control, as the Jesuits have St. Joseph here in town. But the Augustinians were a large and widespread order, somewhat similar to the Dominicans and the Franciscans, when Martin Luther became a monk, and he became an Augustinian. But the same is the Premonstrants were another group formed shortly after the beginning of the Dominicans and the Franciscans, and adopting the Augustinian rule, but following the general idea of the mendicant monks. And the Premonstrants became very numerous in England and in Germany. You will often read of them in detailed history of the succeeding centuries. And another similar group is the Carmelites. The Carmelites as you, of course, immediately recognize the name is from Mount Carmel. And there were a group of people who said that they came from an order that had been founded by Elijah, and that his first disciples had been Jonah, Micah, and Obadiah, and that Obadiah's wife had been the first abbess of the female community. Actually, we have no evidence about the Carmelites back of 1185, but it would seem that during the Crusades, there were some people who stayed on Mount Carmel. A few people did and established a convent there, and eventually developed an order which took over the principles of the Dominicans and the Franciscans to some extent. And so the Carmelites was another of the orders founded then. There have been altogether probably 400 or 500 orders founded, of which probably between 200 and 300 are still in existence today. I'm only mentioning some of the most common and the largest, but the Dominicans and the Franciscans and the Jesuits and the Benedictines are four orders that anyone who is interested in religious conditions at all ought to know something about. The number eight, varying conditions of the friars. Varying conditions of the friars. And we have to recognize that, like all human organizations, there were ups and downs in their condition. The founders had very definite ideals, and people associate themselves to follow these ideals, and then they drift away from them. And then there may be somebody who makes a big effort to bring them back to them. And so there are changes in any human organization. But the original life of St. Francis made a tremendous impression on all of Europe. And the Franciscans were received with great honor all through Europe and grew extremely rapidly. The Dominicans grew more slowly and yet quite rapidly. And the Dominicans and the Franciscans, both of them, began to try to get their men into professorships in the various universities in Europe. And during the next two or three centuries, practically all of the leading Christian scholars, and I think you can almost say practically all the scholars, were either Franciscans or Dominicans or members of some similar order. While before this time, there had been nothing of the kind. Before this time, the monasteries had not been particularly interested in the universities, and some of their men might be educated, others not, but they were no important factor in the universities. But from this time on, the Dominicans and the Franciscans were tremendously influential in the universities and in writing and in scholarship. Both of them have this strong rule from the top, which is characteristic of most of the monastic orders.
I have a friend who is a lawyer in Wilmington and often rides on the train to Philadelphia, and he told me a few years ago how one time he was in the train and happened to sit next to a fellow and got to talking to the man. Of course, if you were in many countries, the Franciscans and the Dominicans, they would all wear their particular garbs, but in this country, most don't. And so it was only after he talked to this man a little bit, he found out he was a Franciscan monk. And he found he was taking work at the University of Pennsylvania. And he said, "What are you studying?" And he said, "Medieval history." And this lawyer, whose interest, I guess, was largely confined to law, said, "Sounds horrible." And he said, the man said, "It is. I detest it." Well, he said, "What are you studying it for?" Well, he says, "I'm ordered to. That's the orders. I have no choice in." And they simply lay out their orders, and the man is supposed to obey whatever he's told. The Jesuit Ignatius Loyola carried this principle much further than any others had before. Loyola taught his men that you should be like a piece of wood, that the order can pick up and move where it wants to, use in any way that it desires. You should have no desires of your own except to do what the order commands you. But none of the other orders had ever carried this to the extreme that the Jesuit did carry. My wife's brother had a pal when he was a boy who used to play with a great deal in Baltimore, and this boy became a Jesuit. And his mother was visiting, the mother of my wife, and remarked to her one day that her son told her, said, he never goes to bed at night with knowing, but what, when he wakes up, he might find pinned to his pillow a piece of paper which says, go to Alaska, or go to Argentina, or most anywhere, and he immediately starts, because that is the discipline the Jesuits are on. Well, the Dominicans and the Franciscans, not nearly as much. Yes, Mr.?
As far as the chronology goes, we're now just starting to form the order of the people, in which case when the university just now starting to become practiced, what have they been in the
within the previous century, largely. There had been some started two or three centuries before, but in the 12th century, there had been a number of universities which were started. Now, of course, there's tremendous difference among universities. A university might just be two or three professors that a bunch of students came and studied under a while and left. The organization developed slowly, and some universities were completely controlled by the students who hired the professors, and some were completely controlled by the professors. And it's only over a length of time that gradually established standards came of degrees and of requirements and of the types of organization and all that. But the whole movement took a great step forward from the Dominican and Franciscan interest in it, in developing it, and in making it a training ground for their own men. But that came after this point, of course. Well, we wish that we could say that the Dominicans continued with a single-minded desire to reach people with argument and ideas. But unfortunately, the popes changed them into inquisitors, a great many of them, to a large extent. But in addition to that, there was naturally a declension, as all human organizations suffer from time to time. With the Franciscans, this was perhaps more marked, because their ideals were the different type than those of the Dominicans, and naturally many people joined them who simply were lazy and preferred to live by begging than to do a little work and live a little better. And while at first all through Europe the Dominicans and the Franciscans were received with great honor and people just loved to lavish things on them, it wasn't long before some of the leaders said, I'd rather see an outlaw coming down the street with a sword against me than see a begging friar coming down with his bowl out holding for me to give him something. And they came to be many in all over Europe who greatly detested the begging friars because of their constant begging for money, their constant applying to them to help them and to give to them and all that. And there came to be a great many lazy people among them, but still, they exerted tremendous influence, and there were a great many
very earnest people for what they thought was right or what they were commanded to do, who had a tremendous influence in Europe. Now, Francis himself described the attitude of certain ecclesiastics of his day, and unfortunately his description fits some of the Franciscans in later times. He described the deathbed of a man who remembers his kinsfolk but forgets the poor. And Francis said, "Ye think long to possess the vanities of this world, but ye are deceived, for that day and hour will come wherever ye think not, which ye know not now but ignore it. The body grows sick, death draws near. Here come the friends and relations, saying, make your will. And the sick man looks upon them and sees their weeping and is moved to evil, and thinks within himself, saying, lo, I put my soul and body and all that I have into your hand. That man is truly accursed who trusts and lays his body and soul and all that he has in such hands as these. As the Lord said through his prophet, cursed is he that trusteth in man. Then they send for the priest. The priest says, will you take penance for all your sins? Yes, he says. Will you make satisfaction for what you've done and for whatsoever fraud or deceit you've wrought to men as best you can from out of your substance? No, he says. Why not, says the priest? Because I've committed all to the hands of my kinsfolk and friends. And with this he begins to lose the power of speech, and so the poor wretch dies. And the devil seizes upon his soul and bears it off from the body with such anguish and tribulation as no one can conceive but he who suffers it. And his kinsfolk and friends will bear off and divide his substance, and then they will say, curses on the fellow's soul, for he might have gotten more than he did and given it to us. Meanwhile, the worms gnaw on his body, and thus he loses both body and soul in this transitory world and will go to hell to be tormented world without end. And you see the simple language and the clear expression of simple ideas, which had a tremendous effect as these Franciscans went about. But, of course, the time came when they, like the priest he describes there, were trying to get what they could for their order. And so you had many gradations, as you do have in any human organization. Well, we'll continue there with the imposition tomorrow.